supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Thanks to gentrification, it's becoming tougher to find an affordable place to live in Philadelphia, especially if you're a renter. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A new report out from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia measures just how much of a dent gentrification's been putting in the city's stock of affordable housing. WHYY's Katie Culinary joins me now to break it all down. And Katie, what are the main takeaways from the research?
So they found that the city has lost more than 20,000 affordable apartments since 2000. So we're talking about places that were going for $750 a month or less, disappearing at a rate of more than 1,000 per year.
Now, why $750 per month?
So the researchers said that's because it's the maximum rent a typical Philadelphia renter could afford without spending more than a third of their income on housing. So this research shows that there are a handful of neighborhoods that are just becoming unaffordable for a lot of people in the city. And you could probably guess where this is happening. It's places like University City in West Philadelphia and the neighborhood very close to our studio here near Jefferson University Hospital. These are areas where gentrification's booming and where we're seeing a lot of luxury developments going up in the sky. The Fed study found that gentrifying neighborhoods lost low-cost housing units five times more than other parts of the city.
So with that, what are the implications for renters in the city?
Well, that means a lot of people are being forced to move. A study from the Fed last year found that Philadelphians who don't make a lot of money and are more vulnerable financially are at a higher risk of moving to places that are worse off, neighborhoods where there's more crime, there are failing schools, and fewer job opportunities. Interestingly enough, though, the study also found residents who were able to stay and weather those changes were better off. So I asked Eileen DeVringhi about this. She's the researcher with the Fed who worked on both of these studies. And she says it's not clear exactly what's happening to the people who are sticking it out while the price of housing is going up. But she has some ideas.
One thing that seems very likely is that they're probably assuming higher housing costs. We know that higher housing costs can eat into the budget for other kind of essential expenditures. So there's some research about, you know, the trade-off families make between investing in educational enrichment activities for their children. There's some research that suggests that cost-burdened households are more likely to skip doctor's appointments, which can have, you know, long-term consequences for their well-being and certainly their finances.
So we've got market rate rents rising. What happens when we bring Section 8 or federally subsidized housing rates into the mix?
Well, the Fed researchers looked at that, too, and they found that the gentrifying neighborhoods actually had a higher concentration of these subsidized housing units. But they're at risk, too. They found that 14% of subsidized rentals in these neighborhoods are set to expire in 5 years. Housing advocates have seen this coming for a while, and they've been raising the alarm bells. Nora Liktash is with the Philadelphia Coalition for Affordable Communities, and that group has been pushing the city to raise more money to keep these affordable units online.
The developers are often private developers, and they're not required to keep affordability beyond the compliance period. They can't afford to keep the affordability because there are capital needs, you know, new roofs, things need to be replaced. So we need to have resources for that replacement to ensure that we continue having affordable subsidized rental units.
So Liktash is hoping that armed with this new data from the Fed, she'll be able to make a better case for this money.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Katie Culinary on NewsWorks Tonight. School shootings in the United States used to happen around once a year, though between the years 2013 and 2015, a shooting took place on average once a week. Researchers from Boston University and Columbia analyzed news reports on school shootings. They found that states with background checks and increased funding for mental health services have lower rates of gun violence. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports.
Not only has the overall incidence of school shootings increased, but the analysis finds the majority of shootings are intentional and carried out by males. However, New Jersey and other states with laws requiring background checks for firearm and ammunition purchases higher per capita spending on mental health and education, and densely populated cities had a lower rate of gunfire at schools.
Here we find that background check laws might be effective, might help in preventing some of these school shootings.
That's Dr. Bindu Kalizan, an epidemiologist at BU who led the study. By combing through the LexisNexis database that tracks news stories, she and her team compiled records of school shootings reported by media outlets between 2013 and 2015. A dearth of national statistics on the incidence of gun violence in schools frustrated the researchers. And as a scientist, Dr. Kalizan says she was unsatisfied with having to rely on news reports to track school shootings because the data is incomplete.
What we learned from that experience of going through all the 900-something reports is that we definitely need a national surveillance registry on all these, and we need more granular data so that we are able to understand these events in a more detailed fashion.
Between 2013 and 2015, Delaware had two school shootings and Pennsylvania had five. New Jersey had none. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
New Jersey lawmakers yesterday nixed a measure allowing Governor Chris Christie to profit from publishing a book while still in office. Joining us instead to write the 2016 chapter of Corpus Christi is Politico New Jersey's Matt Friedman. Matt, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
What do you say we do this as a chronology? And when January 2016 came around, things were looking pretty good for Christie. He was a Republican candidate for president.
He had just come off sort of a short-lived comeback in New Hampshire, where all of a sudden he had sort of shot nearly to the top of the Republican candidates after months and months of hard work in that state. Then he had a dismal, I think it was a 10th place finish in Iowa. And then after that, as soon as he started coming up in New Hampshire, John Kasich and Marco Rubio made sure to run some negative ads against him, and that took him down pretty quick. By February, he had finished 6th place in New Hampshire, where he had pinned all his hopes. That wasn't good enough, and he dropped his campaign.
Though there was a quick recovery just a few weeks later when he endorsed Donald Trump.
From a New Jersey perspective, everyone was asking the question, does he come back to New Jersey and try to sort of repeat what he had in his first term, which were, you know, legislative achievements? I think he used to call it doing big things. Or would he continue to pursue a political career of some sort outside of New Jersey? Within a few weeks, it became clear that it was going to be the latter when he came out and endorsed Donald Trump. And then he became sort of a top Donald Trump surrogate, because at the time, there weren't a lot of establishment Republicans backing Donald Trump. Christie was really the first one. So he started traveling around the country again a bit, campaigning for him. That caused a lot of trouble for him at home. Even some Republicans were saying if Christie is going to spend his time campaigning for Donald Trump, then he really shouldn't be governor anymore.
Nonetheless, in July, Christie was on the short list to serve as Trump's running mate.
It turns out, you know, according to many news reports, that Trump had even offered the slot, but had ultimately been talked down from it. There have been a lot of reasons floated for that. There's been talk of they saw Bridgegate as a huge liability and the trial was about to begin. That would have been accurate. After that, you know, it wasn't too long before the Bridgegate trial began. And that was really the worst of the worst for Governor Christie.
And indeed, Christie and even three of his associates were personas non grata from the transition team.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, there was a bit of a purge there. And his former chief of staff, Rich Bagger, and his one of his closest, you know, political allies and friends, Bill Palatucci, were both unceremoniously dumped from the team.
Review with us the October event when a complaint of misconduct alleging that Christie knew about the closures was allowed to proceed.
Sure. Well, we had just gone through much of the trial. Witnesses and the government did not dispute, the prosecutors did not dispute that the governor knew of the lane closures as they were happening. The complaint said he should have done something.
Of course, last month, a federal jury returned guilty verdicts. Former Christie aides Bill Baroni and Bridget Ann Kelly. And it seems like there's a pretty direct relationship between the year proceeding and a fall in the court of a public appeal for Chris Christie.
The Bridgegate scandal really started his slide. This is a governor who 4 years ago had an approval rating in the 70% range. After the election and then the Bridgegate scandal hitting, we saw that fall into the 40s. But what really, really took apart Christie's approval rating when it really started to slide the most was when he just continued to spend more and more time out of New Jersey prepping for a presidential run. And it just kept going down and down and down and worse and worse. And the Bridgegate trial only worsened his approval rating to the point where he is 1 point away from having the worst gubernatorial approval rating in recorded history, at least that I've been able to find.
Should a position in the Trump administration not come to fruition, what are some of the big tasks left for the remainder of his term?
Well, New Jersey is facing, as usual, we're always facing budget deficits. We just did pass a gas tax that's going to fix the Transportation Trust Fund. But the governor now says that one of his top priorities is going to be one of the bills that failed yesterday, removing the legal ads from the newspapers. He wants to bring it back. And that is widely seen as him exacting revenge for what has been very critical coverage over the last couple years. He'll also hopefully want to get the project formerly known as Xanadu, now known as American Dream, really working on all cylinders. That has, I think he's the fifth governor now that that project has stalled under. There's always a lot for a New Jersey governor on the plate.
Thanks for catching us up on 2016.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Politico New Jersey's Matt Friedman on Newsworks Tonight. Last night, we reported on a group of parents at James Dobson Elementary School in Manayunk. This past spring, parents became upset, believing the school district of Philadelphia planned to overload their school with special education students. They worried these kids would change the character of the school, making it less attractive to middle-income parents. By mid-May, they'd met with district officials, making no progress. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron picks up the story from there.
At the heart of this story is a very pushy parent, and I don't think she'd mind that description. Her name is Lauren Perez, and she has two sons at Dobson.
I'm, like, committed to making things better. I just get so involved.
Earlier this year, she found out Dobson would be getting a second teacher specifically dedicated to teaching emotional support, or ES, students. These are students with extreme emotional distress. They can often be disruptive. And she believes that this extra teacher will allow the district to place more ES students in her school. And that, she thinks, is a dangerous thing.
My ability to market the school as a choice for people just got shot in the leg.
By the time June rolls around, Perez has forced the district to meet with her and other parents three times. In Perez's version, at the final meeting, the district makes a wink-wink deal with the parents. It basically says, look, we're going to serve all the emotional support students at your school now, but we won't add others from outside the neighborhood, even though Dobson is technically supposed to be a regional hub for students with emotional disabilities.
They helped us. They did. There's nothing like it. They did.
When we asked to speak with teachers and administrators at Dobson, we were redirected to the district's central office. And the district says it didn't make any wink-wink promises. Natalie Hess, who oversees special ed for the whole city, says the district simply told parents there was never a plan to add more emotional support students. The extra teacher was just that, an extra teacher.
I think that we have been able to explain that we are providing the service and support that the students that are currently enrolled in the building need and require, and that we're not looking to fill the school with emotional support students, but rather serve the population at hand.
Through a right-to-know request, WHYY recently obtained a series of emails sent among district officials, and they indicate two things. One, district officials told Dobson parents that their school did have room for more students. Two, despite this, district officials said they'd make every effort to ensure the school didn't take on any more special education students from outside the area near the school. Now, just because they told the parents this doesn't mean they intend to do it, but it appears they at least told the parents, look, you win.
It's not a good, I mean, I don't feel good about it. I mean, I don't feel good about it. It's like the stuff, that's why the stuff, that, like these victories, they're not really, it's not like you feel like you've made a, it's not like that. It's not like you're like, if you can only look at it from that perspective, that your school, it feels okay, but then...
Perez knows if the special ed kids don't wind up at Dobson, they aren't going to just disappear.
So if they're not here, where? If they're not here, somewhere else. They get shoved somewhere else.
Research shows that kids who need emotional support are disproportionately low income. And in Philadelphia, the schools that serve the most emotionally troubled students also serve a higher than average share of students in poverty. Special education attorney Daniel Cooper says that's no coincidence.
So, you know, if you are growing up in a neighborhood that is stricken with poverty, where there are gunshots out your window, that is going to lead to mental health issues.
Dobson was this weird exception. It was a relatively well-off school dealing with the types of problems usually confined to high-poverty schools. That set off the parents, but it also brought to light what Cooper sees as a larger theme in the choices parents make.
No parent wants their kid with kids that are, and I hate to say it, but kids that are different. You know, everyone wants a school, you know, with kids that are like them.
Before Lauren Perez got her kids into Dobson, she was a struggling single mom, a waitress who needed government assistance to get by. She'd clawed for years to move into a neighborhood like Manayunk. And the way she sees it, that's just life in an urban school district. You fight for your little patch of adequacy, and then you defend it.
It's like you just can't think of every person that died making your jeans, you know? You like, it's like you can't spend, you can only do as much as you can do. Someone's always going to get hurt. Always.
But her kids hadn't gotten hurt. Not this time. And the district, it had pacified a group of upset parents. It was as close as you could get to a happy ending. And it didn't feel happy at all. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
The 19th century playwright Oscar Wilde is not someone you might associate with children's stories. But he wrote them, apparently to read to his two sons. His collection, called The Happy Prince and Other Tales, five stories in all, has been adapted for the stage in a show called Wild Tales. It's the holiday production at Quintessence Theater Group in Mount Airy. Newsworks theater blogger Howard Shapiro offers this review.
The five stories that compose the show Wild Tales, Wild is spelled with an E on the end, like Oscar's last name, seem sort of dark for a holiday production, or for that matter, as stories for children. They also have a sober tone and story morals I'm not sure children will understand. Here from the production is a part of the moral of a story that pits personal wealth against the wealth within you.
In the treasury house of the soul, there are infinitely precious things that may not be taken from you, and so try to shape your life that external things will not harm you, and try to get rid of personal property.
I can't be sure even Wilde believed that piece of advice, but it does nail the lid down on one of his stories. A New York theater artist named Jeremy Bloom adapted the tales for the stage and directs the production, which I found stiff as a piece of theater. It's like listening to a book being read at library story time, and not always with much inflection. But here, I'll review the audience as much as the play. When I saw Wild Tales at a weekend matinee, the kids in the audience, and many of them were young grade schoolers, seemed wrapped up in the tales. Although they didn't respond because there's little for anyone to gasp, sigh, or laugh over, at intermission I heard several of them tell the adults they were with that they liked the show so far, which I'm sure is good enough response for Quintessence Theater Group. Wild Tales runs at the Sedgwick Theater on Germantown Avenue in Mount Airy through December 31st. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
A new opera debuted at a Philadelphia elementary school today. It's less than 5 minutes long, written and performed by 9-year-olds. Opera Philadelphia facilitated the creation of the work based on the Dr. Seuss story, The Sneetches. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports.
There are actually four operas, each created by a fourth-grade homeroom class at William Camp Elementary in North Philadelphia. Titania Smolin is a teaching artist with Opera Philadelphia. She says it may sound rough, but each group only spent about 6 class periods on their opera.
That's why it's actually simple, because it is original. And majority of the music was written in pentatonic, so only 5 notes sometimes used instead of 7. But it simplifies.
Opera Philadelphia has a long-standing program teaching music in Philadelphia public schools, usually as a one-time drop-in class for about 45 minutes. But this year, the group expanded it into a residency, so Smolin could come back every week for 10 weeks. William Camp Elementary has no music education at all. This is the only exposure to music these kids are going to get during the school day. Smolin chose Dr. Seuss's The Sneetches so she could teach both music and literacy.
The text of Sneetches is actually, it's a pretty difficult text. It's not simple words that we use every day. So we need to get the kids to retell it in their language.
Everyone can be friends forever. Everyone can be friends forever.
If you've forgotten what the Sneetches is about, I'll give you a refresher. A group of creatures with stars on their bellies think they are better than creatures with no stars on their bellies until the no stars are able to artificially put stars on their bellies, and then the original star bellies have their stars removed to regain a sense of exclusion. It's a story about discrimination and ultimately acceptance. Like any good Dr. Seuss story, it seems simple, but underneath, it's really pretty complicated. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Tomorrow evening, we'll evaluate New Jersey's overhaul of its system for who gets bail and on what terms. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.